KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KSL at Night. Tonight you've got me alone, Leah Murray. I am KSL's resident political science professor, chatting about all the interesting things that are happening. If you've missed out on any of our shows, or if you're coming in like in the middle of this conversation we're about to have and you want to go hear the beginning of it, please remember you can always go back and listen to our segments on KSLpodcast.com after the show's been aired, or you could honestly find it on any app that you download your podcast, so you can check back in and make sure you've got all the information you need to go ahead with your day. So we are now joined by Carter Williams, KSL reporter. Welcome to the show, Carter.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Carter, I feel like there's been some drama downtown, or like something's happening in Salt Lake City where some old building was being torn down. Can you tell us what's happening?
Yeah, so what's happening is that there's this old historic, used to be an LDS church that has been vacant for some time, and there really isn't really clear what was expected to happen with that building. There's some rumblings that there was supposed to be a new development, sort of rehashing this building into a new use. So it wasn't necessarily meant to be torn down by any means, but at the same time, there were plans to renovate it. And at some point, somebody started working to tear it down this past weekend, and the city rushed in and stopped it.
So, Carter, real quick, before you get there, I called it an old building. You called it a historic building. What makes it historic?
Well, its history is certainly something that is notable in Salt Lake City and in Utah. It was started as a meeting house, as the name of the building starts out, you know, it indicates it is. You know, it was a church that held this ward, this fifth ward that used to was one of the first wards in Utah. In 1910, this was created to kind of address the growth of this ward. But then it fell apart in the sense that this is an area that had become more industrial instead of residential, so there wasn't really that need. And so it starts with being that part of this old ward that has existed in Utah since almost the founding of the state as a pioneer settlement. So there's that aspect to it, but it's also had all these other uses since it was sold by the LDS Church in the 1970s. So it just has this different reach of uses that have been, you know, monumental to the city. And so what happened is that it was added to the National Register of Historic Places, and that allows it to have some sort of notoriety on a national scale. But it was also made a local landmark by Salt Lake City, which gives it protections where it can't be torn down without going through this huge public process, which it never went through.
All right. So that right there is the hubbub, right, Carter? Thank you. So the answer is it's got, my gosh, it's on a list somewhere of buildings that should be protected. So what does the city do? So just the way you talked about it, someone comes in on the weekend to start to tear it down. Like, tell us where the hubbub is. Like, what is the problem?
Yeah, so what ended up happening is that some demolition crew, and we haven't really heard much about what this crew was, who it was, why they started, and everything that's behind it. But we do know that they started it, and somebody from the city just happened to be driving by and noticed it, and they knew that that area hadn't been slated for any sort of development. So they had reached out to other people who are more focused in that role of city planning and historic buildings, and Salt Lake City has so many historic buildings. They looked up there, they confirmed that it didn't have any sort of production, so they raced out and they stopped everything.
All right, and didn't you interview someone in the city? You've got some sound for that.
Yes, Nick Norris, the planning director for Salt Lake City.
I think just the fact that somebody who's a known developer in the city had crews that they hired out demolishing a building on a weekend without permits, to us is enough that, you know, it certainly destroys whatever trust the city has.
That I find Right? Like, it's on the historic register. It's a landmark in the city. And somebody comes out on the weekend, starts demolishing it. And the only reason it stopped is because someone, right, like, just happens to be driving by. Seems crazy to me. Can you talk to us about, like, what are the next steps? Like, how, like you said, we don't know who was behind it. Does that make sense? We're not sure what company was demolishing it. Like, what happens next?
Yeah, that's what's still being sorted out right now. I think this investigation is going to center around how this even happened in the first place, because the name that was sent out on the notice, that is a developer that's been around for over a decade. They've had dozens of buildings in Salt Lake City. We don't know if they're the ones who called on it. We don't know if it was a miscommunication. That's some of the stuff that will be sorted out as a part of this investigation. So we're talking about fines and the potential that those responsible for it will be forced to rebuild what they destroyed. So there are a lot of things in that regard. Meanwhile, the Salt Lake City Council, they were already supposed to talk about this idea because there's been incidences already involving historic buildings that didn't have the same sort of protections. That led to some conversations about new rules and regulations to prevent stuff like this from happening. That was going through this process before this incident, but it's now being sped up. The council is supposed to talk about it today. They're going to talk about it in the next couple of weeks and potentially pass it as early as next month. That would allow, I think, more protections for these historic buildings.
Right. No, that's interesting. So Salt Lake City's already kind of aware that there are historic sites, right, in place, and that maybe, I don't know, I have the imagining that someone doesn't have the list or something, right? Like, there's a list somewhere, and maybe two ends of the city are not talking to each other, right? And so you've got just kind of miscommunication, maybe. I don't think anything malicious is happening, just kind of losing track of some of our sites.
What makes this more interesting, I think, in regards to all the other historic ones, there have been buildings that have been torn down that were on the National Register. But again, they don't have those same protections. This is the first instance that the city officials can say that they can think of where we're talking about a city landmark, something that has these protections that the city wants to have preserved. And it was demolished without any of these conversations.
Right. So they're hoping to pass tonight some kind of strength in enforcement, right?
So what would be passed today is just setting up the framework for that to be passed. So they would be setting up a public hearing for that to be discussed on a public scale. And then they would vote next month to potentially enact this new rule.
All right. So what happens, Carter, in the meantime? Does that make sense? So I guess my question is, and maybe you don't know, so maybe we're just speculating, but what is the building sitting, like, has it been torn down is what I guess I'm trying to ask, or is it sitting there, halted demolition, and we're waiting to see, right? Does that make sense? Is it kind of like being protected in the meantime?
I think that's what they're working on right now. They want to make sure they have fencing. There's been some unconfirmed, but likely confirmed cases of people taking items from the site already. So that's not ideal
in
any situation. So I think the city, especially yesterday, they were working to get fencing up there to kind of secure that site, to make sure that you don't have that sort of looting that happens. That's very potentially a concern there. I think that's what they're starting with. And then all that stuff will be figured out in the coming weeks.
All right. Carter Williams, thank you so much for joining us this evening, KSL reporter, and we'll have you back when you find out more of what's going on.
That sounds great.
Okay, listeners, when we get back after the break, we'll go a little dark because Chad Daybell is on trial. We will be joined by Greg Skordis, who is our KSL legal analyst and who's been tracking the Daybell trials for the last, oh my gosh, a long time. We've been talking about this, and we'll get into it after the break.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are exploring all the interesting things that are happening in the world right now. Maybe one of the more kind of like dark or depressing interesting things that is happening is the trial of Chad Daybell. Luckily, I've got with us our fabulous favorite co-host on KSL at Night, who is also KSL's legal analyst, Greg Skordis, to help us understand what's happening. Greg, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Leah.
All right, so Greg, let's assume everybody knows who Chad Daybell is, but just in case they don't, can you give us a real, like, top of the line, what trial are we talking about? Who is this guy? And then tell us what's been happening recently.
Yeah, so Chad is the co-defendant of Lori Vallow, who, as you recall, had her trial a year ago, and it involved the deaths of her children, Tylee and JJ. Her trial went forward. She was convicted last April or May. I think the trial started in April, and the jury verdict came back in May. And she is currently serving her sentence, although she's in Arizona awaiting trial on other homicide charges there. Chad's case has taken a slightly different track because his is a capital case, meaning the death penalty is still on the table. And so his trial started yesterday with what we call jury selection, and the judge had thought that it might take a week to select a jury. What the judge wanted was to get 50 people who could sit out of the hundreds that have been called, and then the lawyers could select the 12 that they need plus the six alternates, so 18 total by the end of this week. And so far they've got 20 of the 50 that they want, so about 10 a day. We're thinking maybe by the end of this week they'll have the 50. Then the jury will be selected from that pool on Monday. I believe we could have opening statements as early as Tuesday. But the jury selection process has taken much longer than it did for Lori, in part because, Leah, this is a death penalty case, and so the jury has to be willing to follow the law as it relates to the death penalty. They have to be willing to impose that penalty if all the circumstances line up.
Oh, that's interesting. So pause right there, Greg. If you're being called to serve on a jury for a death penalty trial, one of the things you have to say is, I would be okay giving someone the death penalty.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, but you have to be able to follow the law. You may say philosophically, I'm against the death penalty, but if the facts fit that, I will vote to impose the death penalty. And if you can't, then you're not willing to follow the law, and you'll be excluded from the jury. So if you have, religious or personal or moral reasons why you absolutely could not impose the punishment of the death penalty, you can't serve on the jury. So It's an additional qualification that we have only for death penalty cases that we don't have for any other type of jury trial in America.
All right. So I heard you earlier talking about how you thought probably a plea agreement was being discussed. Do you still think that's true? I mean, the fact that they are moving to getting their jurors and getting all this online, do you think really what Daybell's attorneys now are, we're going to go the distance with this trial?
It's hard to tell, Leah. Once you get to this point where they're selecting a jury, it becomes less and less likely that the case will settle. But there are always the chances that it'll settle. I mean, I've had cases settle even after the jury trial has started. I just thought with the death penalty being on the table that there might be some plea in the works where perhaps Chad would agree to a life in prison without the possibility of parole in order to be spared execution. And I thought the state might be willing to agree to that. I don't know which side was unwilling to get to that point, but it appears that for whatever reason, that's not going to be on the table, at least for the time being. And of course, cases like this are always fluid. So something could still happen. But right now, the state is going, and the judge is having both sides go forward with the trial and probably start opening statements, and witnesses will be called as early probably as next Tuesday.
Yeah. So, Greg, you just talked about witnesses. I remember with the Lori Vallow case, there were no witnesses called. And I remember you talking about the government, like that her lawyers must have thought the government couldn't make their case. But in this one, I think I read somewhere that there's at least seven expert witnesses being called for Chad Daybell. So this defense will actually put on a defense, right, which is different from what we saw in Lori Vallow's trial. Can you talk to us about why that's happening?
Yeah, so you're right. There were no defense witnesses called. Obviously, the state put on its case in the Lori Vallow case. But Lori's attorneys, I think, argued from the very beginning that the state just didn't have enough evidence. And so they didn't feel like they needed to put any witnesses on. Well, of course, they ended up being wrong. And so I don't think Chad can rely on that same thing. So he's probably looking at experts as they relate to the DNA, to some of the forensics that were done, to the investigation that was done, and maybe even challenging some of the findings by the medical examiner. But he's got a list of experts that he's calling in his trial because he's not going to rely on the fact that maybe the state just doesn't have enough evidence to convict. I mean, he's going full speed ahead, and I would expect that's going to lengthen the trial significantly.
All right, so how long do you think the trial is going to be? So you're saying, I think you said, probably opening statements next week because we'll have jurors in place the end of this week. How long do you think we're talking about this?
Well, Lori's trial went 5 weeks, and Chad's is expected to go twice that amount of time. So they said 4 to 5 weeks, it went 5. Chad's are saying 10 to 12 weeks. My guess is it will go 10 to 12 weeks. And by the way, if he is convicted, there will be a second trial called the penalty phase where the jury will consider what his punishment will be. And in death penalty cases, the jury also decides the punishment, which is an entirely separate trial where the jury considers more than just the facts of the case, whether a crime was committed, but what should be done with the accused. So that could lengthen the trial significantly also.
So, Greg, I feel like if I had gotten called to be a juror in this case, like I'd walk in and say, I know he's guilty. I mean, to a certain extent, it feels like everybody knows, right? Like if Lori Vallow was guilty, I feel like it's the same case. So clearly he is too. Why would he not be pleading? Do you have any sense? Does that make sense, like of what his lawyers or what he is thinking?
Well, he's going to try to get 12 jurors that can say, we'll put aside whatever happened in Lori's case and judge this case solely on the evidence that's presented by the state as it relates to Chad. And he has that right. The state has that obligation. And the judge has that duty to make sure that he gets all of those rights covered for him. So, yeah. While Lori was convicted and the evidence is largely the same, he may claim that she was the mastermind. She was the one that did most of the things that occurred here, that he had limited involvement. And he may also just challenge the evidence in general that the state's got in ways that Lori didn't in her trial.
Greg, do you honestly think they can find, do you know what I mean? Like 12 people who are going to do what you just said they have an obligation to do? I mean, it seems... Right? Like, this just seems really difficult to me.
Well, in 2 days, Leah, they found 20, and they need 30 more to whittle down to the 12 to 18 that they're going to have. So, yes, they've managed to find people in that area. We're talking Ada County, which is the Boise is the county seat. I mean, the crime is alleged to have occurred in southwestern Idaho, but the trial's in Boise because it's a much bigger venue for that exact reason. So you can have a bigger jury pool who may not have heard as much about the trial, may not have formed opinions about it, and some may not know anything at all about it. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but you can find jurors who are willing to hear the evidence and decide the case based solely on what the state presents and not what happened in another trial a year ago.
Greg, when you are watching what's happening kind of the next little while, are there, how do I say, signs you would be looking for? Does that make sense to see a trial's going one way or the other?
Yeah, I'll be really interested, Leah, in the opening statements next week. I'm interested in seeing what Chad's lawyers say. I went up for the opening statements in the Lori Vallow case and was disappointed because her attorneys basically said, we don't think the state has enough evidence. I mean, that was their argument, and I appreciate that, which is I thought they would lay out what their case was. Chad's lawyers have to do that, and I think his opening statements by his attorneys will be really interesting to see what evidence they have, what they think they're going to put on in front of the jury to persuade them that he's not guilty of these three homicides and multiple property crimes.
Greg Skordas, KSL legal analyst, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Nice to be with you, Leah, as always.
Next up on KSL at Night, let's have a conversation about what happens when the state legislature starts paying attention to higher education.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we're talking about all the interesting things going on in the world today. So yesterday, I was sitting in a meeting up at Weber State University with a bunch of college people, which is maybe not as cool as it really sounds, but maybe it was exciting. And we were talking about the possibilities and the effects of sub 120 credit hour degrees, which maybe doesn't mean anything to most of you. 120 credit hours is what you need to get kind of generally standard across the nation for an undergraduate degree. It's 4 years, assuming you're taking 15 credit hours every semester of 4 years of college. And the reason we were talking about maybe doing something different and having degrees that had less than 120 credit hours was the state legislature had kind of opened up some space in the policy for that conversation. I was thoughtful about kind of what that means and how higher ed feels about it. And then I feel like in the ether, everyone's talking about it because yesterday in the Salt Lake Tribune, there's an article about what Utah college presidents think is the next target, right? So what they're talking about is the legislature has passed some bills about higher education. These bills included DEI. They included what I'm talking about, getting lower credits for graduation. They did some tuition things. And then some bills that failed, like maybe having a general education degree sitting at the University of Utah or having accreditation bodies look a little different than what we've seen. And the thing is, you know, campus presidents and quite frankly, people like myself are thinking about this. To understand what's going on, I'm bringing in Jessica Euler, Vice President for Student Access and Success up at Weber State University. If for no other reason, listeners, than she was in the room with me at that meeting yesterday and has some real insight about how this affects campuses. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Jessica, to what extent when a legislature passes bills, right, and we're in Utah, but I imagine you could speak how this looks nationally as well, what does it how does it affect you as an administrator on campus?
Yeah, gosh, it's kind of an ongoing conversation year round. So particularly in the legislative session on higher education campuses, we are watching what legislation is going on. There are different folks on campus who are having conversations about the topics, but the real conversations kind of begin now in preparation for the next year. Now, when legislation itself is passed, what that looks like is us on our campuses and whatever state we're in or whatever campus we're on of what does this mean for us? How do we implement it? And some of it is, you know, seeking clarification or looking to intent of the legislation that was passed. That absolutely in a state like Utah, when the legislative session ended on March 1st and there were bills that are going into effect on May 1st and July 1st, particularly that impact us. A lot of the conversations are, okay, how are we going to implement these and the ways that works best for our campuses and also meets the intent of the legislature?
So let's talk about, I like how you just said, thinking about next year, which I think was the theme of the article I read in the Trib. In that article, we see language that says higher education is bracing for what is next in the firing line. Jessica, that sounds like a really tense relationship, right? So if I am talking about bracing for what's coming up next, that's not me being super happy about what might be coming down the pike. Can you speak to why the relationship is so tense between higher ed and the legislature that we would liken it to a firing line?
Yeah, I think a lot of that headline was probably, precipitated by conversations that are happening on the national level. I think particularly in an election year, things feel more charged. Not to say that folks don't feel that way in Utah, but I think that what this comes down to is our legislature has a vested interest in us in the greater community, just like we have a vested interest in, you know, producing graduates that are going to go back out and give back to the community as well. So really, it's not intended to be a tense relationship. Sometimes there are certainly challenges, but I think that's where it provides opportunity to really engage in constructive dialogue. Because if we're doing this right, it's a symbiotic relationship between higher education institutions and the legislature.
Oh, I love that. Because I feel like then we must not be doing it right, Jessica, because I'm not sure how symbiotic it feels. Because one of the things that's in this article is, University of Utah President Taylor Randall saying we need to get out ahead of it, right? So what does that look like if the relationship is working the way it should?
I think part of it is engaging in productive conversation year-round and not engaging in conversation just in the moment or when we know about something, right? Because I think a lot of this comes from situations where we're talking past each other. And that could be me being overly optimistic, of course, but like assuming the best intent on everyone, I think when we look at the goals of the legislature and the goals of higher education, it's to really have informed citizens who are giving back. So in situations like this, where we're talking about we need to get ahead of next year, you know, one of the pieces of legislation that's also mentioned in that article is focusing on what does general education look like? Well, over the last few years in particular, the Utah system of higher education has really taken this opportunity to take a step back and look at, say, the differences in gen ed requirements, where they'd range from 27 to, I think it was 45 credit hours across institutions, and that even things like the passing grades changed are different from institution to institution. And the work that's been done at the, you know, system level has really started to engage in conversations of how can we ensure that there's consistent pass rates for ease of transfer between our institutions, because then we're moving forward all higher education institutions in the state. And looking at this variability in general education requirements isn't really meeting the needs of our students and helping them to graduate. How can we get to a place where now that what's about to go into effect is that the requirements are 27 to 30 hours at all institutions, so it provides that level of consistency. But what we can do is start talking about those, because sometimes in higher education, we have a tendency to wait to talk about things until it's completely done and not engaging in that back and forth conversation throughout the process to really engage the greater community and helping us to make those decisions as well.
All right. So I love that you went to curriculum. So let's just go there. Jeff Landward, who I think is our new UShe commissioner, was quoted in this article as saying, and correct me, Jessica, if I've got that title wrong, is quoted in this article as saying they are watching. So I assume he means the legislature, and they're paying attention to what a unified general education experience looks like in Utah. Is Commissioner Landward right? Like, is it the case that the legislature is paying attention so little bit?
Yeah, totally. So he will be the official commissioner right after the Senate confirms him. But he's been recommended, and so effectively is the commissioner, just has that one more step to get through. In terms of kind of what does this look like, would this head off future conversations about curriculum? I think a lot of it is looking at how we're talking about it. I think we have an example a few years back where the legislature, and maybe it was more than a few years at this point, where we're looking at things like transfer credits between institutions, and the legislature's like, for heaven's sake, folks can't transfer between institutions. You're not even accepting credits from other institutions. And so the institutions took that time to take a step back. And now we serve as a model for the rest of the nation in terms of the fact that our general education, if you take it at one institution, a public institution in Utah, you can transfer it to another one without having the headaches that are there. I think we have the same opportunity with things like general education. So when Commissioner Landward said that they're watching, I think they certainly are. And part of that is because they're looking to see how we implement the legislation from this year. They're also looking because they're concerned about producing graduates that are ready to meet the needs of our greater community. And the national conversation and the conversation here in Utah is, what is the value of higher education? Are we producing high quality graduates? What is the return on investment? And so I absolutely do think that the legislature is watching us because they have a responsibility to help out the community, right? But I think making sure that we're having that back and forth conversation and talking about what we're doing and hoping to move forward and not just presenting a final product that we think meets their needs without engaging conversation. And conversation is really a place that we can start.
Okay, Jessica Euler, Vice President, Student Access and Success up at Weber State University. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Next up on KSL at Night, we're going to have a conversation about social media and the possible effects some changes at Meta will have on our election information. Stay with us.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and I am chatting with really interesting guests about all the interesting things that are happening today in the world. So here's the thing. We talk a lot about social media on this show, and we've talked a lot about the damage it can do to teenagers. We've talked quite a bit about how Utah is suing some of the social media giants, kind of depending on what problem it is that they are trying to solve. But the thing is, we're rolling into a presidential election year.
So there's actually another area that we can be talking about, which is politics and how social media intersects with political content. So as you are scrolling, you are probably starting to see political ads. You might be seeing some political content. You might start seeing some of the drama that's happening in a presidential election year. Inside the state of Utah, we've got a Senate race. We've got a governor's race. We've got an attorney general's race. I mean, like, all sorts of fun things happening politically up and down the ballot. And I'm going to tell you what, social media is going to reflect that. What's interesting is Meta, which is the owner of Facebook and Instagram and Threads, is now automatically enrolling all of their 3 billion, my goodness, 3 billion users in a setting that limits their platforms from suggesting political content. So my understanding is, like, if you're someone like me, I'm going to tell you I follow a lot of political people, right? So if you're a political scientist or a political science professor, you're going to be following people. It wouldn't affect that. Like, they're not going to turn off me getting information from the political thought leaders that I follow. But it won't suggest political content unless I opt into getting those suggestions. I'm trying to figure all this out. Luckily, I've got with us Earl Foote, CEO and founder at Nexus IT. He's a technology expert. Earl, welcome to the show.
Leah, thanks for having me on. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, Earl, first, make sure you correct anything that I just said. And then, but also talk to us. What is Meta doing? Like, what is going on here?
Everything that you said, Leah, is accurate. It's interesting in a day and age where in political conversations, there is so much polarization and so much divisiveness. We're now going to have a conversation around divisiveness in social media's role in it, right? The interesting thing is that, as you mentioned, Meta has made a decision to, rather than having an opt-out feature, they've enabled an opt-in feature and now have, by default, disabled any political related content in your feeds, unless it's somebody you are connected to or follow. The why behind, there can be a lot of speculation, and there has been a lot of speculation about, Meta's own political leanings as an organization or of its founders, you know, in the past. You can certainly, think about those sort of topics, whether they're relevant or not. In the end, you know, Meta's position on this, what they have stated, is that they've made the decision based upon their user base, the requests of their user base, as well as past scrutiny that they face. And in the interest of having no political alignment projected onto them, they've chosen to simply remove political content from feeds unless you're opting into wanting to see that political content, right? Also, again, stating that their users, by and large, are saying that they would prefer to see personal content, stay in contact with friends and family, and not necessarily see political content. You and I are in very different worlds, Leah, and probably have very different sort of perspectives, on this. I personally find the lack of social and emotional intelligence that we bring to political conversations today to be quite off-putting. And I personally don't really want it in my social media feed. I personally kind of like that bifurcation. But I realize my personal opinion doesn't represent everybody's opinion either.
Yeah, no. Earl, I appreciate that point so much, right? So the answer is humans are still human when they're in social media. And so the things that make Thanksgiving dinner awkward sometimes would make a conversation in a feed, right, awkward sometimes. But let me ask you a question as a college professor of 18 to 22-year-olds, right? So not super aware of what's happening in the news, really not checked into what is happening on the planet. If I told you what Threads top trending cases were, one of those is that there was like an attack on the World Central Kitchen, and I'm going to tell you that a lot of young people maybe don't even know what that alludes to, right? That we're talking about the Gaza conflict and that's happening over there. So my question is, if I'm asking these 18 to 22 year olds to be like fully functioning citizens of our republic,
Right. And I know that most of the information they get about anything comes from their social media feed. Like, your point's well taken, Earl, but I worry a little bit, right, about maybe if they follow me because they're in my family, right, you know, some of the young people in my life, or if they follow me because I'm their professor, if they were able to say, I want to only see Dr. Murray when she's, you know, like running the half marathon, right, or like they only want the personal stuff, then they maybe never get enough information secondarily, if that makes sense, to have knowledge, to know what's going on in the world. And a little bit what I like about feeds that are not bifurcated the way you said that you like them is because you kind of accidentally get knowledge. Does that worry you at all? I mean, like, some people are concerned about that kind of accidental, you know, information uptake, if you will.
It is a very real consideration, as well as, you know, freedom of speech is a very real consideration. Yeah. And I certainly am not an advocate for limiting anybody's freedoms of speech or freedom to be able to consume the content they want to consume, right? You know, this situation, and candidly, I am one of those who, you know, even though I am a Gen Xer, the majority of my news now comes through social media.
Yeah.
You know, I don't turn the TV or the radio on nearly as much as I did when I was younger. I see a lot more of it, you know, on my mobile device now than I do on those more traditional platforms. And so, I totally see in my children being Gen Zers, you know, the majority of their wherewithal of the world comes from social media. So there's a definite consideration there. I think there's a couple of, you know, other things that we have to think about. One is that these are privately held companies. That means that it is in the decision of those entities, their boards, you know, their shareholders, to make decisions about, you know, how to steer and guide that company. And they don't necessarily need to be a public service. You know, that isn't necessarily their civic duty, right? So there is that sort of piece. The other piece is, I can tell you from my side of the coin, which is, you know, my expertise is in cybersecurity, data privacy. There is a massive amount of misinformation out there, you know, and political misinformation. In fact, there has been a significant amount of social media content proved to have come from nefarious or malicious nation states outside of our own, who are trying to spin specific political narratives to influence the political leanings of the American public, to even influence elections. And so while I agree with you, Leah, that I think that it's positive for those who don't potentially have ready access to news and political information to be able to obtain that in the platform of their preference, I also know that there's a lot of information that can mislead them and misguide them. Does that information accurately give somebody who receives no information about politics at all, does it give them a holistic view to be able to make a well-rounded decision around that information? Potentially not, or even, you know, potentially be misguided. So I think there's a bigger picture there. But I also agree with you on, you know, I would like the American public to be informed and to understand, you know, what's happening in our country, in our world, and to be able to make smart decisions and you know, form smart perspectives around it. Is social media the place for that? I don't know, right? Again, it's a privatized sort of platform, not a public, you know, entity that's or public services being provided, you know, by the government.
Earl Foote, CEO and founder at Nexus IT. This is all so complicated. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I'm sure we'll have you back as we keep exploring what's going on with it.
Thank you, Leah. It was a lot of fun.
All right, listeners, thank you so much for being with us this evening. If you missed any of it or you came in halfway through a segment and you're dying to know what we were talking about, make sure to check out our podcast. You can always go back and listen on kslpodcast.com or any app where you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time.